All through the year, when I've started, as I usually do, with an appropriate piece about the month's weather, I've often found myself having to explain that, well, in fact, it hasn't been quite like that. And it's true that in November, although we've had a few sharp frosts, you couldn't exactly say the ground had hardened, just as well for those who were late with their ploughing. But when I left home at the beginning of the month to begin my recordings, November obliged with some typical weather conditions.
The shepherds almost wonder where they dwell, and the old dog for his right journey stares. The path leads somewhere, but they cannot tell, and neighbor meets with neighbor unawares. The maiden passes close beside her cow, and wanders on, and thinks her far away. The plowman goes unseen behind his plow, and seems to lose his horses half the day. The lazy mist creeps on in journey slow. The maidens shout and wonder where they go. So dull and dark are the November days.
It wasn't quite as bad as that in my village of Elam, but the Elam Valley, when I left it, was shrouded in mist, if not in actual fog. It wasn't till I came to my destination, on the uplands a few miles to the north, that the sun came blazing out.
In one way, I'm sorry that the weather's turned out so fine up here, because what I'm looking at the moment would do rather better to be shrouded in fog. It's a desolate collection of ruined buildings, rusty wire, and cracked concrete. And even on a sunny day like this, it's a pretty sorry sight. I'm standing pretty near the spot where the first coal was brought to the surface from what was to become one of the deepest coal mines in the country. And if you thought that Kent didn't have coal mines, well, you're quite right. It hasn't. Not anymore.
Thousands of miners and their supporters from pits the length and breadth of Britain came to London today to demonstrate their anger at the pit closures. Amongst them were former Kent miners, whose pits were closed 2 years ago.
Former Kent miners are travelling to London to join a mass lobby of Parliament in protest at the pit closures.
Philip Sutcliffe spent 20 years at Kent Snowdown Colliery. He now works night shifts at a nearby roofing manufacturer's. Feeling among ex-pit workers is as strong as ever.
Once a miner, always a miner.
One thing about pit life is solidarity, comradeship, something that no one can experience other than being in a coal mine.
When the miners of Kent heard about the government's proposed pit closures last month, they'd been there before. In fact, the first of the four main collieries in Kent to close, Chislett, to the north of Snowdown, lasted barely 50 years. The three others, Snowdown itself, or Snowdon as it's often pronounced, Tilmanstone and Bettshanger, lasted longer. Jerry Blanchet is an habitué of my favourite local pub, the King's Arms in Elam, and he's an expert on all sorts of local history, especially the coalfield.
The first sinkings were in the Dover Colliery, which was at Shakespeare Cliff. But that was never commercially viable, and that took place just before the turn of the century, more or less as a spin-off from the Channel Tunnel workings.
That's the abortive Channel Tunnel of 1881, of course, not today's monster. The shaft at Shakespeare Cliff was started in 1891. 14 years later, the seam had yielded the massive total of 12 tons. But this didn't stop a sort of Klondike coal rush of exploration all over Kent and into Sussex, and it even reached Elam. I found out from another expert, Derek Borton, that there was a borehole more or less on the spot where I was riding in a tractor in last month's programme. That's barely a quarter of a mile away from where we were sitting, needless to say, in the public bar of the King's Arms.
It was very near the station, and I've got a couple of photographs, one of which locates it, and the other shows chaps in front of the head of the boring, one of whom I know the name of. The rest, I think, are either itinerant workers. Some of them were actually Dutch. And of course, it happened in 1913-14, and I'm afraid some of the locals couldn't tell the difference between Dutchmen and Germans, so they had rather a hard time. The only one I can identify is the chap just on the right of the photograph, whose name was Frank Terry, and who married the sister of Bert Want, who I think has been your informant on a number of occasions during this series.
He certainly has, yes. Presumably those guys...
They may well have been here. Yes. And apparently they did find coal, but not in quantities that were worth exploiting.
So Elam missed its chance of becoming a mining village. Of course, when the pits did finally get off the ground, or rather under it, there weren't any mining villages. Indeed, there wasn't much of anything around except farmland.
You were establishing a coal field in a rural area where there was no real infrastructure to deal with it, either in transport or in terms of housing or in terms of labour force or in terms of skills needed. And so the skills had to be imported. The transport system had to be laid down to take the coal to the port in Dover.
So when the miners who'd been recruited from all over the country, from Wales, from Yorkshire, from the Forest of Dean, even as far as Scotland, when they finally arrived, some of them having walked all the way, they weren't coming to paradise.
Many of these miners who lived in these rural villages had to maybe cycle in to the pits. There was always a problem with transport. Sometimes coaches were laid on. But you're talking about most unsociable hours, you know. And another bone of contention with the miners was that, of course, they weren't paid for getting to the pit. They weren't paid for waiting to go down in the cage. They weren't paid for the time that it took to get from the bottom of the shaft through the gates up to the face. Their earning only started when they were actually digging coal on a piecework basis.
And of course, when the miner did get to the coal face, it was no paradise there either. More like an inferno.
Sometimes he's working in water up to your knees, shoveling coal and so on, drowned wet through. But not cold, water was warm and you were sweating. And perhaps snap time you'd have to come out and change your pants and put another set on because it was colder in the road than what it was in the face. My feet was a bit bad, I got bunions, because the only way you could get a rest in the face was to sit in on your feet or kneel. You couldn't stand up. Not in a 4'6" seam.
Now that's the voice of a fairly rare breed, a Kent-born miner. As I've said, the main base of the workforce came from all over.
They were sustained in their own communities, which were gradually built up, specifically as mining communities, where they played games like rugby. They set up Dumpton Park races. They founded various societies, particularly gardening societies and so on, and built their own cultures. And, of course, lived in their own little county groupings, where they retain their own dialect and their own way of speech for many, many years.
That regional solidarity, plus the natural comradeship of men who depend on their mates to stay alive, and perhaps spurred on by the particularly horrendous conditions in Kent, conspired to make the Kent Coalfield, right from the start, one of the most militant in the country. In Kent, you'd have had to go a long way to find a blackleg, a man who works while his mates are on strike. And you'd be really hard pushed to find one at Bettshanger Colliery. There, they even had a strike during the war.
Of course, it was illegal to strike under wartime regulations. So something had to be done about it. And it was done. And it was done in a very heavy-handed way. Three union officials sent to Canterbury Jail. 1,000 underground workers had gone on strike. 35 of these were fined £3 each, and the rest were fined £1 each. But it caused all sorts of problems because the local police, of whom there were only two or three, I think, had to cycle around delivering all these summons to 1,000 men. Another problem was that they ran out of summons notices. So it caused absolute mayhem, and the strike immediately threatened to go to other mining areas, and the government had to do something about it.
Well, they did, And what they did was to let the Union leaders out of jail, to the delight of their comrades.
They got on their feet and they marched to the jail and they released the Union men and they came back and had a day off the next day and had a party.
For the miners, it was a great victory. The Union officials came out of Canterbury Jail to be greeted by the colliery bands, and a great march took place back to the pits in triumph and exultation over the whole matter.
Betts Hanger, the fighting pit, finally succumbed just like the others. It was the very last to close in 1989. Now, all this, you might think, must have bypassed Elam altogether. And so it did, mostly. But there was one man who actually cycled from Elam to Snowdon, and that's a very, very long way. His name was Tom Revel.
Ex-guardsman, very tall, upright chap, who would walk across the old market square at Elam to the King's Arms every morning with his little Jack Russell at his heels, very upright. And he liked an argument. Well, Elam being a hunting village, it was quite a county village, and Tom Revel was spoken of as being the only socialist in Elam, but the only Tory at the pit.
Going to the King's Arms, eh? Shows good taste. Regular listeners to the programme may have noticed that in the past 2 months there have been no references at all to what is, after all, virtually my Elam recording studio. Well, the fact is that, having stood about for 500 years or so, the old kings showed signs of getting tired, and the handsome front, with its hung Kent pigtails, threatened to fall into the square. Ted, the landlord, had heard of open plan, but this was ridiculous, so for quite a time the pub has been hidden behind scaffolding and boards. But there's good news to end this not-too-cheerful tale of hardship and job loss. The King's is about to emerge phoenix-like from its cocoon with a glossy brand new sign, a great relief to us all. I suggested we have an ox roast and fireworks in the square to celebrate, but Ted didn't quite see it that way.
We're going to have a bring along evening.
Well, I'll bring this microphone along, how about that?
No, it'll be lovely. And then look forward to the spring when it's all flowered outside of it. It'll be grand.
It will be grand indeed. Meanwhile, we'll hide away from the November fog by the fireside in the King's Arms with a pint.
Give me my native nuts, brown ale, all other drinks I scorn. Or English cheer is English beer, our own John Barleycorn. Aye, John Barleycorn, oh, John Barleycorn. Old and young, thy praises sung, John.